Hello, I'm Misha, and this is the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. I've been studying Chinese whilst working full-time in the UK for about 4 years now. I'm currently at a solid intermediate level and can comfortably hold conversations with native speakers. I recently started a blog documenting my efforts of striving towards fluency and also to help other learners who are at the beginning of their studies. As an independent learner based in the UK, the first 2 years of my studies were spent figuring out what I should be doing. So the goal of this podcast and of this blog is to help you speed up that process. Each episode, I'll be interviewing insightful guests who have expertise in learning Mandarin and discuss insights and tips based on my experience. If you like this podcast, then please leave a review and subscribe on imlearningmandarin.com. So on today's episode, I discuss learning Mandarin with a man who's not only learned the language for himself, he's also observed the trajectories of hundreds of other learners over the years. Max Hobbs is marketing director at the leading Chinese language school, LTL Mandarin. He first came into contact with Chinese whilst backpacking in 2014 and has since continued to study Mandarin while working at LTL. His position at the school has given him a real bird's eye view, observing and documenting the stories of numerous students at the school he works for. I found it really insightful to talk to him about his learning experiences and in particular his observations of which attitudes and traits are the strongest predictors of a successful Mandarin learner. So Max, welcome to the podcast.
Hi Misha, thanks very much for having us.
So I'm interested first of all in exploring more about your gap year in 2014, and this was when you first came into contact with the Chinese language, I believe. So how did that gap year come about? Why did you choose to go to China? And what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, it was an interesting one that kind of came out of the blue, really. So I graduated from university in 2010, which seems like a lifetime ago now. And then I picked up a job in digital marketing, which is what I actually do now. So it was kind of something I gained a passion in over my time at university. But I kind of reached the peak of where I could get to at my job. There wasn't really much more room to grow. And I thought, being kind of in my mid-20s, it was the perfect time. So I never really had that traditional gap year that people normally have before they go to uni at 18. So I thought it would be a good time to try it. And I kind of just had a look at ways to fund it, really, because I didn't have a huge amount of money in the background. And teaching English was something that came up quite often on my research. And with the rate of pay in China for teaching English, which is quite good, and the cost of living, which was much cheaper than somewhere like Japan or Singapore or Korea, it seemed like quite a good fit. So I did some research, contacted a few agents and whatnot, and I was placed in a city called Shenyang, which is in the northeast of China, so the freezing cold area in the winters, which is a bit of a culture shock. But that was my first experience and how it came about. So I didn't actually go there with much kind of language history at all. In fact, at school, I'd studied French and German, and like 95% of the people in the class, no one cared, which is really bad. And I look back at it now and wish we'd looked differently at it. But it was kind of the lesson where people would, let's say, doss around and not really do much work. So I never really had a passion for language before, but it was going to China where I realized how fascinating it was when you drive down the streets in the taxi or you'd be on a bike and you'd look at all the characters. And it was almost for me like a code to decrypt. My background was a web designer at university, and that was kind of very much kind of coding and creating solutions from scratch. And I think maybe that part of me kind of liked it, because it wasn't a language at the start. It was more a code that I needed to decrypt. And the more you learn and the more you discover, the more addictive I found it became. So although I didn't make a huge amount of progress in spoken Chinese in that year, because I spent most of my time speaking English, it was the Chinese characters that really got my passion going for the language. So that was kind of where it came about, really, in my first year.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people who do gap years in China or who go to China to teach English, they often go with a vague idea in their mind that they will at some point try and learn Chinese. But in the majority of cases, it's probably fair to say most people who live in China for a period of time probably don't actually end up picking up that much Chinese. A lot of expats live in China without really knowing any Chinese at all. Was that kind of your experience of the people that were surrounding you? And what was kind of different in your case that made you actually make a concerted effort to begin learning Chinese?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it's spot on as well, actually. So, I mean, from my experience in Shenyang, where the population there is 8 million, so it's about the same as London, but the expat community is very, very small, and everyone gets to know everyone. And although that's great on a social side, and socially had a fantastic year out there, it was so much fun. But the problem is, as a learner, you are always sucked into a foreign bubble of speaking English. So you have to make a concerted effort to put yourself out of those bubbles and into more Chinese ones. And obviously that's quite difficult, especially when you're a beginner, because when you go to somewhere so what is at the time quite strange to what you're used to, it's you want familiarity. So you want to talk about the things back home. You want to talk about where you can get a roast dinner, where you can go to the pub, where you can watch football. And normally you do that with foreigners, or you might do it with Chinese people, but they are the ones who speak really good English. So, I mean, if I look back at the people I met there, a vast majority of them spoke, like you said, very beginner Chinese. It would be the, can I have a beer? You know, how many people at a table? Jaga, which is the famous phrase that all foreigners learn at the start, which is this one. And that's as far as it goes, really. There were exceptions. So I did meet a couple of them who, you know, spoke much better Chinese, but otherwise it wasn't very good.
So after a year, then you returned to the UK. And so that would have been in 2015. And then you were in the UK for another 2 years. Within that period, then, did you maintain any of the conversational Chinese that you'd picked up during your time there, your first stint in China?
Very little, to be honest. But I made an effort to. So I was regularly in touch with people on WeChat, which is the Chinese WhatsApp, let's say, for people who aren't aware of WeChat. So I would be in regular touch. I actually went back to Shenyang a year later for 3 weeks. Again, this was mainly a social exercise to see friends. I had some time off to use and thought it would be great to go back there again. So I was very much drawn to my time there. But again, there wasn't a lot of Chinese going on. It was just generally conversationally on WeChat. And the journey I made with Chinese, I found is quite interesting compared to others, because many foreigners who go to university and study Chinese read and write it very well, but when it comes to speaking, they generally stumble and have a hard time of it. Whereas mine ended up being quite the opposite, because I managed to absorb the language before even really learning it. So I was much more confident when it came to spoken Chinese. So when I would send messages to friends, it wouldn't be typed, it would be voice messages, which is, again, something that's very common in China. And I've noticed now I'm back in the UK, it's not so common for people to send voice messages. And when I do send them, I generally get raised eyebrows. Like, what are you sending me a voice message for? It was something, a technique I used to help my spoken Chinese, but it was very basic stuff. It was just keeping up with the basics. And I hadn't actually planned to go back to China. It wasn't until this chance job opening came and, you know, a few Zoom meetings with this Mandarin school in China, where it all came about. And they offered me a position 2 years later in 2017, and the fit was perfect. I had no ties in England. Again, my next job, I was kind of coming to a brick wall with it, really. And I just jumped at the chance to go back there and give it another shot. And I think the fact that it was a Mandarin school as well, it made me think that I can go there and not only, you know, enjoy it and have a good time, but I can really make some progress here. And I had no excuse on my second time. And really, from there, my first 2 weeks on my second stint was intensive Mandarin. And that was the moment where I really felt things turned.
So you say the first 2 weeks, this was in your second stint, were extremely intensive. So could you describe that a bit more in terms of what was intense about it?
Yeah, so I mean, really, it was the hours that I was studying. I mean, if I give you a day in the life of for my first kind of 2 weeks, so the company I work for, LTL Mandarin School, kindly put me up in a homestay for my first month. So this allowed me time to find a place. And homestays are a big part of what LTL do. It's about taking what you learn in the classroom and taking it home and utilizing it with a family. So I lived with a Chinese family, lovely mum and a dad, and they had two children from memory. And so I would wake up each day, I would have breakfast with them. My Chinese was very limited then, but it allowed me to improve a bit. And then at school, I was doing 4 hours of small group class. So this was 10 till 12 and then 1 till 3. And then I would do 2 further hours of one-on-one slash homework study, which was 3:30 to 5:30. And then I would go back home and I would have dinner with my homestay family. And it's essentially then becoming a, you know, you're awake for, I don't know, 16, 18 hours a day. I was using Chinese nearly all of those hours, bar the odd, you know, meeting other students and getting to know the students in that time. But it's very much a community where people also don't really want to go there and speak English. They want to go there and speak Chinese. So even with foreigners, you generally hear Chinese being spoken a lot to varying levels, which is really great. And it was such fun to be a part of that sort of community for my first 2 weeks. So that was kind of how the first 2 weeks worked, really. And then, unfortunately, I had to stop doing those classes that they kindly gave me and I had to start working.
So at that point then, would you say that your conversational Chinese was still stronger than your reading? And at what point did you really start focusing more on characters and reading?
Yeah, so in answer to the first question, yes, I was definitely more confident with spoken still. I remember being in the class and my small group class was 4 people, really great group of people as well. I had a lot of fun with them. And I remember seeing characters being drawn on the board and they were rattling them off with no problem. And I was thinking, I think they've put me in the wrong class here. But then when it came to speaking, I felt very, you know, quite at ease with it a lot of the time, really. And I felt that if I saw another student struggling for a word, in my head I was like, I know that word. So it's the thing with Chinese, isn't it? There's lots of different levels. You have speaking, you have reading, you have writing, and it's very rare that you have students increase all of them at the same level at the same time. So I decided really to focus on reading because those 2 weeks allowed me to pin down what I was, you know, good at and what I really needed to improve at. And I just started self-studying really, but it also helped that I was in an office slash school where there's characters all over the place. So what I really liked about the school was that they had flashcards everywhere for, you know, toilet, kitchen, cup, stapler, pen, computer. So every day, every moment, I was absorbing these words. And then, as you know, with Chinese, when you learn characters like dian for electric, it then opens the door up for TV, dian shi, and computer, dian nao. And then it just starts to repeat and repeat. And I had so much fun with it because it's quite motivating when you can read 100 characters, you think, well, let's get to 200 and then continue and continue. And it's an endless thing that, you know, you will never know all the characters in Chinese. So it's always one of those things that you can just keep on going to your heart's content. And it was a steady progression from there, really.
Mm, absolutely. So you then remained in China for a further 3 years until the pandemic in 2020. So what was your progress like during that period? And what was your kind of learning routine like over that period of time?
Yeah, so I think the first year, so 2017-18, was the year I really felt progress. You know, I was by no means fluent, but I felt like I could do what I needed to do when I wanted to do it, bar, you know, maybe some of the more difficult things. I felt I could go and register at the police station, which is something you have to do every time you come back into China. That was quite scary at first, but it became easier. One of the fun tasks that foreigners generally always have to do is go to a bank in China. And that is typically a very odd experience when you're new to it because they, no matter how many foreigners go into the bank, it requires 5 or 6 staff to investigate your passport very closely for a long amount of time before they allow you to do what you want to do. And that obviously is quite scary at the start because, you know, they're asking questions at native speaker level with masks on and understanding them is difficult at first. But I think the first year, it's also easier to see your progress when you're at the beginning stages as well because you can see your progress faster. I think when you get to intermediate and advanced, it's harder to monitor and judge as much. But that first year, essentially what it was, I would have 1 or 2 classes every week at LTL in between my work, which is part of my contract, which is great. All the foreigners at LTL get lessons each week. And I would just make sure I spoke with the teachers quite often. I think this was quite a good thing because, yes, you can use your lessons, but also any moment you can take, you know, going to the kitchen and getting the coffee turned into a lesson. When there was Chinese staff in there, you would learn a new word, or you would make a mistake and say the wrong word, and or you would, your sentence structure would be wrong, and you could go back to the desk, you know, with a new lesson in your back pocket. So I think a lot of it was being really social, putting myself out there. A lot of self-study at home. So I've got pads and pads here where, you know, I was kind of writing sentences and trying to cram stuff in. So it was a lot of self-study time. I remember particularly in January 2018, so after 6 months, it was freezing cold and horribly polluted outside. And I spent a lot of that month at home watching YouTube videos, listening to podcasts, you know, about learning Chinese, absorbing as much as possible. And then I think the second and third years were continual steady improvements. Obviously, there was times where I took some time off and I needed a break, or my motivation was low. There were definitely times where I felt I was stagnating a bit. But again, this is part of a language learning journey. It's never a straight upwards curve. As with anything in life, you have to accept that there will be times where it slows down, or you're demotivated, or whatnot. But when you like it enough and when you love it enough, it generally always comes back, I've found.
So at some point then, after that, you were forced to return to the UK, and that was in 2020, and you now work from the UK. So what was that like, and what was the process of continuing your studies and maintaining the language back in the UK like for you?
Yeah, so it was new really, wasn't it? Because it's something that we all had to get used to unexpectedly. I actually went to Hong Kong first, but again, there's little to no Mandarin there, so it didn't really help. The only thing it helped with was characters. And then I actually went to Italy, which is where my wife is from. We lived there for a bit. So my Chinese stagnated quite a bit during that time, because I started to take up Italian, and that became my focus. But coming back to the UK, I've been very conscious and wary about losing where I got to. So I made a concerted effort to take on online classes every week. So I've got a few teachers that I use depending on their schedules. Obviously, our time zones are a bit different, and we generally just talk. There are some times where we would focus on a PDF or a certain lesson or something like that, but generally, there's a lot of free talking in there, current affairs, all that kind of stuff. The stuff that you would normally talk about in an office, just trying to replicate that sort of atmosphere. It's different, and it did take time to get used to, and I still always prefer the face-to-face option. But I think I'm saying that because I spend most of my hours every day, Monday to Friday, behind a computer. So I work on a computer and then I study on a computer, and it's a long time. But can you learn as much online as you could offline? I think you really can. You just have to be a bit more motivated and driven to do it.
One of the things I'm interested in discussing with you is when you're talking about sort of studying Mandarin and your opinions about that, you're not just drawing on sort of your own personal experience, but you also have the vantage point of having observed many different students come and go from the school that you work for. So I'm wondering, when you observe that and when you reflect on that, what are some of the trends that you see in terms of predictors of success? What the kinds of attitudes and mentalities and preparation going into learning Chinese that tend to lead to the best outcomes in the students that you've observed over the years?
It's a really good question, actually. I must admit, I think it sounds quite funny, this, but hear me out. I think the ones who are the least social in the foreign bubbles tend to do the best. It's very easy at school, isn't it? To, you know, I love to do it, meeting friends, meeting people. It's really great fun. You share your experiences. But the problem is always the same. You all end up speaking English. And the ones, actually, I remember a particular Russian student called Vera. She was really young when she came. She was only 17. And she couldn't speak any English or Chinese. And it was a really brave move. You know, this young girl coming to China. And yeah, she took it in her stride. She was in a class with, I remember, a German and a Canadian. And the Canadian girl, Alana, and Vera, who couldn't communicate in any language, ended up becoming very close friends and communicating through broken Chinese. And Vera's progress has been great. In fact, we follow her on Instagram. She follows us on Instagram. And I see her speaking superb Chinese, all from the fact that she was forced to do that because she had no other way to communicate with people. There's a couple of other examples of people I know who came and they were actually very sociable people, but they made sure they didn't get stuck in the foreign bubbles too much. So while they would perhaps go for a beer or hot pot with foreigners, they would also make sure that they went out and made Chinese friends, or they would spend a bit of time with their extra time with their teacher, or they would speak with the staff at our school who are the Chinese staff, or they would, you know, look for contacts for clubs. So football clubs is a popular one, or a Tai Chi club or a yoga club, or go to the park and strike up a random conversation with people about Chinese chess, which takes a lot of guts to do that. But you get students that do it, and it's really fascinating seeing the different routes people take. And I think, like you said, it's actually a big advantage and quite a privilege to be able to do that, because I can see firsthand how people do it. And the majority do come and fall into the foreign bubble. I was one of them, got no shame in saying that, but I made sure after a certain amount of time that, okay, I've got this foreign bubble and I can use it, but I also need to put time to the other side where I just use Chinese, whether that be on my own, whether I'm talking to myself, or meeting a friend who only speaks Chinese. And you need to dedicate that sort of time if you want to make quicker progress. So I think that was that's an interesting way to put it. Be less social with the foreigners and more social with the Chinese.
I'm thinking in the era of the global pandemic specifically, I guess things have changed a little bit in that sense, in that many people are learning Chinese online mostly and often outside of China. So I guess the temptation to sort of hang around in an expat bubble might not be as present under those conditions. I'm wondering, under the current conditions, do you see any kind of similar trends in terms of what kind of mentalities and attitudes tend to do the best when they're studying from a computer remotely abroad?
Yeah, it is difficult, I think, and the main thing about that is motivation. I think when you're in China, especially the tier 2, 3, 4 cities, you have no choice, but you have to face it. Even when you're not in the mood for it, even when you can't be bothered or you're too tired, you have to face it. And that is a big part, again, of what we do, or what we encourage people to do, is that what defines a success is those difficult situations where you just want to tear your hair out, or you're sick of it and you don't know what to do, but you find a way because you have to. And when obviously you're abroad and you're studying online, you can't do that. It's very easy then to switch the computer off and you know, go back into English or your native language straight away and forget it. So I think a key part is keeping motivation, but also maybe making a few tweaks that maybe you wouldn't think to do normally. And one that really helped me, that Andreas, who's actually my boss, told me to do, was switching my phone to Chinese, which I laughed at him when he first told me this, because I said, there's no chance I'm ever going to do that. But he told me that this is a very, very good technique. So I thought when I got my Chinese to a good enough level, I would try it. And I've never had my phone in English since. So it's actually in Italian at the moment, because I'm trying to plug that forward. But the fact is, we use our phones too much. We use them all the time. So why face yourself with English or whatever your native language is when you can put Chinese in there? And the same goes for computers. The same goes for TV shows, the music you listen to, all these kinds of things. You can embed it into your life, but it depends how much you want to do it. And I think when you're doing it online, you have to push yourself more than what you would have to online, where you've got no choice, you have to face it. So it's difficult and it is different, but it's just tweaking and changing little habits that you don't think will make a difference, but they actually do. So I think that's one thing, it's just having that mental power to do so. And I think Instagram has proved quite useful, I think, for a lot of people, because I see nowadays lots of StudyGram accounts. They're very popular. Chinese StudyGram accounts, and people map out their progress. And I've seen this huge StudyGram community, you know, explode with so many people from all around the world, and they help each other, they push each other on, they set challenges, they do online meetups, they do lives together. I think this is a really, really cool way for people to learn from behind the screen, and you get to know friends from all around the world. We try to partake and communicate with a lot of these StudyGrammers. And there's some really lovely people on there with great tips and tricks and resources. So I think that would be something that I would also recommend and mention, but there's no doubt the challenge is harder, but I think the resources are so much stronger than they've ever been. We have access to so much stuff. You go back 20 years, you know, we had the internet and whatnot. We had dial-up, but we didn't have anything like YouTube videos or even podcasts or streaming. But now we've got no excuses. We've got everything we need. It's just all in our mindset, I think.
Looking forward then, one thing I'm interested in is that most people studying Chinese are hoping that at some point in the future, and hopefully in the not too distant future, there will be opportunities to go back to China or to go to China to study. And in my own case, that's something that I would very much like to do in the future. When I first started studying Chinese, there was, I would tell people about my interest in Chinese, and a lot of people would say from the beginning, you should just go to China straight away. I always felt in my own case that it made more sense to get to a level of Chinese where I was able to converse and handle myself from outside of China before then immersing myself when it felt like I was more ready to do that. I'm wondering, what would your advice be around that if you were advising new people studying Chinese? Would it be in the future to go straight away and dive in the deep end from day one? Or would it be to take advantage of all the online resources that you've just mentioned, study from abroad, build up your level to a certain degree, and then when you're ready to delve into the full immersion experience?
Yeah, it's a good discussion, actually, because I think there's merit to both of those. I think if someone comes to me and says, I don't know any Chinese, I don't even know how to say hello, but I want to go to China, should I go? I would certainly never say no to that. If I was given an optimum program or an optimum kind of schedule, I would say that it would be to do what you've done, really. And I know you were kind of forced into doing that by the pandemic, but still, I think it might work out in your favor because, like we just said, there are so many great resources out there online. You can absorb and listen to so many things that it will make your life infinitely easier. And there's just too many good things out there to use, many of them free as well, by the way. So a lot of them don't even cost any money, especially YouTube and Spotify, where you can just go on there and listen to stuff. And then, you know, I would go, let's just to pin a level on it, like a HSK2 sort of level. So knowing something like 300 to 500 characters, being able to introduce yourself, what you like to do, what you like to eat, and maybe, you know, give replies to some basic questions like how was your weekend or what do you plan to do. That will make your life infinitely easier when you go there. That would be the optimum thing to do, but I certainly wouldn't say to someone who said, you know, I want to go to China now, I don't know anything, I would never say to them, well, you're crazy, because actually I did that, and although I didn't do it for language purposes at the time, I felt how different it was in all elements. It's not like going to France or Germany or Italy, where if you are on the road, you can kind of hear similar words or read similar words. You know, even sometimes in Russian, you can kind of roughly guess certain words. Chinese, you've got no chance. It is completely different. You're starting from scratch and you've got to get used to it. And you having that basis when you go there is going to make a big difference, especially with reading things like menus and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And one thing I will say is I briefly, a few years ago, it's a story I often tell, had this brief experience of immersion in a Chinese environment at quite a low level. So what happened was I went to Taiwan on a 3-week trip and I did a work away for a week. And at that time, I was probably around HSK3 level, which I'd been told was an intermediate level. When I arrived at my workaway, it was working in a hotel, a traditional like Taiwanese tea house. And the lady that ran the hotel didn't speak any English. So I was kind of fully immersed. And I thought I was, as I say, intermediate. And so I thought I would handle myself. But very quickly, it became clear that I couldn't really handle myself and that the woman would very quickly lose patience and just get the Google Translate out, start translating my chores to make the bed, which I wasn't able to understand in Chinese, into English. But I think the key thing that comes down to is management of expectations, because what I was going into that trip thinking was that I would quite quickly, in an immersive environment,
pick up a lot of Chinese that was around me, and because I'd reached this nominally intermediate level, that it wouldn't be too difficult for me to handle myself. And in the end, the reality didn't match my expectation. So I think that was more the issue. But do you think that management of expectations then of people who are making a choice to go to China in the future is key?
Yeah, I think that's a really great example that many people can draw on. I think actually part of this is down to the problems with the HSK really, and they're actually addressing those now with HSK3 is actually becoming a beginner level. So I think that part of it is due to this, and I saw this many, many times with students, and this is one of the most common things where students would reach a HSK 5 level in their own country. So HSK 5 supposedly being the second top level, so supposedly advanced. And they would come to China with this strong level. They could read very well. They'd have no problems writing. But when it comes to speaking, even relatively basic things, they would freeze. And their tones weren't quite there. So this then became a problem for them, where they thought that they were coming to China as advanced speakers, but actually they were very beginner level speakers who could read well. And it's important to know yourself where your strengths and weaknesses lie. And then, of course, like you said, that can help you manage your expectations. If you can read and write, fantastic. You'll have no problem, you know, looking at signs on the street or maybe reading a menu or seeing what the shop sells, what offers they have. But when it comes to communicating, you need to realise maybe that it's going to be a bit more difficult. So I think expectation management is absolutely something. It's difficult to know as well when you're new to the language, to know exactly where you're at. And the HSK should be telling us roughly. So what the HSK3 was telling you was that you should be, you know, roughly halfway to fluency if you look at it in that sort of the fact that there's six levels. So I think that's probably a fault of the HSK in that part, but it's definitely something to be aware of, and it's something that I would wholeheartedly recommend to first-timers in China, is that be aware of where you're at with your listening, with your speaking, with your reading and with your writing, because they're all very different and they can help out in different scenarios. But for me, the one that I really loved improving was the speaking, because that is what you use to make friends and communicate with people.
Well, Max, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and particularly hearing your insights, not just from your own personal experience, but also from observing so many students come and go over the years at the school that you work for. So once again, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having us, Misha. It's been a pleasure.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.